seminar called Theologies of Resistance Reconciliation. It began as a seminar, a graduate seminar on Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Martin Luther King Jr. It's expanded over the years to Bonhoeffer, Niebuhr, King, and Dorothy Zola. I think Larry was colleagues at one point with the last two on that list. I can't think of a better person to speak to us today as we move from Bonhoeffer into Niebuhr. I first discovered Larry's work when I was writing a doctoral dissertation decades ago on Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And I came to this gem of a book called Resistance and Reality. Is that the title? I'm so bad in titles. that I recommend all of you to find. It's available in a new paperback edition. I had not realized until recently that part of that book was based on a sabbatical year. Was it a DAAD fellowship or a Fulbright fellowship in Berlin? Towards the end of your doctoral studies in New York, during which you interviewed members of the German resistance, former students of Bonhoeffer, both in Berlin and in Finkenwalde, Eberhard Beke, other people associated with the church struggle and with the conspiracy, and that those amazing sort of voices that appear in quoted texts throughout the book are based on that historical field work that we hope to have available in some digital form, maybe sometime in the next year. And, Larry's work in Bonhoeffer studies is of international renown. The reason that this is such an ideal, scholar to bring in can be explained partly by Larry's title, which is the Reinhold Niebuhr Emeritus Professor of Social Ethics at Union Seminary, New York. One of the aspects of Professor Rasmussen's, theological, intellectual vocation that has so inspired me, and I know many colleagues in my generation, is the way that he has responded to difficult questions raised by both Bonhoeffer and Niebuhr regarding the purpose of intellectual life, the role of faith in the world, an exemplification of a vocation that responds almost directly to a haunting question that Bonhoeffer asks in a letter to his family and to friends in late 1942. Bonhoeffer is surveying the ruins of the German Christian Church. He's in, the city. The cities are in a state of rubble. He's in a Gestapo prison. And he will soon be in a Gestapo prison. And he sort of surveys the kind of moral landscape of the Berlin German Bildungsbürgertum, the upper educated middle class. And I think there are also echoes of his thinking about the church. And out of this eloquent kind of summation suddenly leaps the question, are we still of any use? I think I speak for many who say that Larry's career and his civil courage and his honesty and his probing concern for a range of issues, the kind of pioneer work in theology and environmental ethics, is found in these three volumes of canonical works that I have in my desk, has exemplified the reason. Yeah, if we are of any use, it's minds and souls like Professor Rasmussen who are going to be lights for us. And I know that's probably a little too heavy for you to hear, Larry, but nonetheless, grateful for you being here. I do have a more descriptive introduction that runs 7 pages that I'll share with you via text message or whatever the messaging portal is on Zoom. We are thrilled that you're here, and the screen is all yours, brother.
Yeah, thank you, Charles. Well, I'm delighted to be here. And I will say that the document to which you made reference with the paragraph, Are You of Any Use, is a document called After 10 Years, and Bonhoeffer wrote it as a Christmas essay, a Christmas present to members, certain members of the resistance movement trying to overthrow the Hitler regime. And the After 10 Years is a reference to the fact that they've now spent from 1933 till Christmas 1943, or New Year's 1943, resisting German fascism. What have they learned? I think it's one of the classic essays in Christian ethics from anywhere at any time, and I commend it to you. After the election in 2020, we had a class in the congregation of which I'm a part on to reflect on the election and what looked to be the future for us in this country. And they asked me to teach it. And I said, I'll teach it if we'll do one thing. All of us will exegete, we'll take apart the essay after 10 years and see what lessons there are there. So thank you, Charles, for referring to that. Okay. Charles, you might let me know when 40 minutes are up, if you don't mind.
Of course.
Your readings from Niebuhr are from weeks 6, 7, and 9. You have fall break between 7 and 9. And I'm using the title, Why Niebuhr Matters, for my remarks, even though that's still future readings on your course list. I don't have the same source you do, the Library of America volume, but Charles included the chapters in each of your readings so I can find and have found the discussions that way in my copies. What I'm going to do is base my comments on why Niebuhr matters around the readings you have from Niebuhr all 3 weeks, using them usually as context for commentary to Niebuhr. I'm not going to be reading aloud what you're reading on your own. And for my time, I'm going to do the following. First, the leaves from the Notebook of a Tamed Cynic is Niebuhr on his Detroit years. The young pastor is in a growing industrial urban parish. That's new territory for him as a kid from Wright City, Missouri. And he said later that those 13 years in the parish, quote, determined my development more than any of the books I read. So I want to spend a little bit of time on what were for Niebuhr the most determinative years, his parish years. Then I'll go to your topic for today, which is Christian realism, and selections from what was Niebuhr's first really blockbuster major academic work titled Moral Man and Immoral Society. And there I'm going to focus on Niebuhr's theory of power in society that is at the heart of his Christian realism. Niebuhr is always about morality and power. And the Christian realism in Moral Man and Immoral Society lays the foundation for that. And the third and the last of my topics for why Niebuhr matters is Niebuhr on democracy. Well, I've chosen that because we're 1 month or less. Actually, New Mexico's early voting starts today. We're 1 month or less from the most, I think, probably the most fateful presidential election in U.S. history, certainly among them. Thus, that's my choice of topics for the week where you read Children of Light and Children of Darkness. That book, Children of Light and Darkness, is the closest that Niebuhr ever got to filling out the Christian social ethic for which he was famous. I mean, even though he wrote many books, most of his writings as a good social ethicist was topical. It was on the issues of the day for magazines and journals and a lot of op-ed pieces. And just as an example, from 1942 to 1952, 10 years, he wrote 767 articles. None of them as books. Some of the magazines that he wrote for, he himself founded. First one was Radical Religion. Second one of more long-standing tenure and influence was Christianity in Crisis. But Children of Light and Children of Darkness is a good guide to his social ethical framework and substance. I'm addressing, however, only Niebuhr on Democracy from that book. And in fact, I'm going to use a single line. And it's found in the foreword. It's page 13 in my edition. And it goes this way in the language of the time. Man's capacity for justice makes democracy possible. Man's inclination to injustice makes democracy necessary. And I'll probably dwell more on the second clause. Inclination to injustice makes democracy necessary, because that's where we are now. And we'll also talk about what he sometimes, other people used it for him more than he did, his Christian realism. We'll talk about it in connection with that defense of democracy. Well, I think we can do these three topics in my allotted time and have the half hour for your comments and questions. My last introductory remark is that all of this is quite personal for me, and there was a kick getting back into the materials here. And I also have to tell you that I never think about Reinhold Niebuhr without at the same time thinking about Martin Luther King. And that's because I was a grad student when Niebuhr was my teacher and King was present in New York from time to time. And I was in the presence of both King and on a weekly basis with Niebuhr. We had a seminar down at the Niebuhr apartment. He had suffered some minor strokes, enough to slow that furious energy and schedule of his and send him into retirement. But still in retirement, he wrote books and he conducted a seminar. The one I had in the Niebuhr apartment was Moral Norms in International Affairs. However, more importantly for me were walks every Monday afternoon with Niebuhr. Ursula, I always loved going to the Niebuhr apartment because there was always so much banter in the apartment. Ursula and he were always exchanging remarks, and Ursula said, "I can't be walking Winnie," that was their standard poodle, named after Winston Churchill, "I can't both be walking Winnie and Reinhold, so you're going to have to walk Reinhold." So I walked Reinhold on Mondays. Other grad students walked him on other days. He had to get out and exercise every day. And the conversation with all the students and faculty always called him Reinie. She didn't. She always called him Reinhold. But the rest of us called him Riney, and the conversation on our walks typically went like this. There would be some commentary to the news of the day. I had to make sure that I had read the New York Times for that day to be prepared. And then it would move on to the moral and ethical dimensions that were surfacing in those events of the day and on the news. And then finally, into theology. So that was a progression. But the theology was always theological anthropology. That is to say, theological renditions of the nature of human nature. That was his topic. And many of you probably know that his most famous two-volume work, from the war years, 1941-1943, was the two-volume work, The Nature and Destiny of Man. That was Niebuhr's topic, and the theological discussion was always a discussion about the nature of human nature. These were, for me, grad school years at Union, 65 to 68. That was also the time of King's intense presence in what was called the Civil Rights Movement. It was, and it wasn't the right title for Niebuhr. For King. The March on Washington was not the March on Washington for Civil Rights. The March on Washington was the March on Washington for jobs and freedom.
Maybe I'll join you after a while.
Pardon?
Yeah.
I want to just about to go.
Oh, well, it's going to keep going. So.
And everyone online, please mute themselves while we listen to the lecture. Thank you.
Oops.
I just want to say that one of my high points of my years, 65 to 68, was with other students being in the presence of Dr. King for his Time to Break Silence speech given at the Riverside Church on April 4th, 1967. And by coincidence, I happened to be in the Riverside Church exactly 1 year to the day later, April 4th, 1968, when John Bennett, interrupted the address to announce King's assassination. Okay, I'm only going to mention two conversation lines on those Mondays in Riverside Park. One, a conversation that I remember vividly. Niebuhr, when he had come back from, it was either a TV show or a radio show, and I don't know which. It was a conversation with James Baldwin about race in the United States. And then I want to go to a conversation about Dr. King. In some cases, they'll go together. So here's a bit about Baldwin. I've written some letters to my grandchildren about this time, and in one entitled Democracy Enhanced, I wrote to them to say, it was stupid of me not to keep a diary of the hours with Niebuhr and the time in King's presence, but I didn't. One conversation does come to mind, however. Aided no doubt by the effort this summer of 2020 and winter of 2021 to finally achieve a breakthrough in reckoning with white racism. Niebuhr had just come from a talk show where he and James Baldwin debated race matters. This must have been 1967, after the Voting Rights Act, 65, and Civil Rights Act, 66, had been signed. Yet King's campaign for economic equality essential to enhance democracy, was considered a bridge too far. As the New Yorker commented about his move north and plans for a poor people's campaign in Washington, King had begun to perceive that society tends to confine its indignation to injustices that can be attenuated without imperiling fundamental economic relationships. And King never succeeded in changing those fundamental economic relationships, not structurally, not systemically, as he set out to do. On our walk, Niebuhr's pace quickened. He was clearly animated about the time with Baldwin. "We may actually clear this hurdle of race," Niebuhr said, "in 100 years, looking straight ahead." I don't recall my exact response beyond exclaiming, 100 years? For students in the 1960s, that timeline was ice water thrown on our idealism. We were confident we could best any balance in our own lifetime. Only later did I learn Baldwin's view. In 1962, he said that the upcoming centennial celebration of the Emancipation Proclamation in 1965 would probably arrive, quote, 100 years too soon. "We Negroes," that was the language of the day, "cannot be free until whites are free." 100 years. Niebuhr and Baldwin both foresaw another century of protracted struggle. They knew what I and my colleagues didn't, namely pandemics that have deep roots and institutional legs, like the pandemic of racism, take a long time to eradicate. Victories come by fits and starts, and contexts have to be engaged anew over and again, not least because the poisonous virus develops new variant strains. This means you should celebrate victories when you can, rest up, return to the struggle with vigor, and pass the torch when you must. Let me go to Niebuhr's formative years in Detroit. Niebuhr was at his best in his ability to render a theological and an ethical interpretation of events as a basis for common action for a wide audience. But because his wide audience was very often an audience of very diverse beliefs, he usually didn't bring his Christian presuppositions and symbols forward in his argument, even when he himself was drawing upon them. Now, the exception, of course, is that he's a pastor in the congregation at this time, and they come forward in his preaching, obviously, and in his other pastor work. But he's engaged in the city's struggles. And this gift of broad communication among diverse peoples he learned in his struggles, especially the racial and the industrial struggles of Detroit. He was a pastor of a small parish, Bethel Evangelical Church, on West Grand Boulevard. Now, don't confuse evangelical in this context with its meaning in the United States. It's from German immigrant Protestant Christians who called themselves evangelical in Germany, still do, Lutheran and Reformed. Detroit then, this is the trauma of World War I. This is the onset of the Depression. This is the move into Henry Ford's assembly line automobile production. This is the struggle of workers for wages there. It's the presence of rank racism, and battles with white superiority. So Niebuhr found himself opposing both Henry Ford and the Ku Klux Klan, championing the labor movement, he always did, chairing the mayor's interracial committee, serving on the Detroit Council Church's Industrial Relations Committee, joining the Fellowship for a Christian Social Order and the Fellowship of Reconciliation, that was a pacifist group, pastoring a congregation that had grown from 65 members to some 600 and had become a community force to be reckoned with. And at the same time, he's traveling widely on denominational and ecumenical tasks, and he's writing for local consumption as well as for national church and secular press. He was writing for the Atlantic Monthly, for The Nation, for The Christian Century, for a magazine called World Tomorrow. He even published his first book. No one knows about it anymore. It's called Does Civilization Need Religion? ? That was 1927. It contained, he said later, almost all the theological windmills against which he would very soon tilt his sword. Further evidence that Detroit was a period of theological ferment for him. It's also at this time that he began frequent travels abroad, joining a seminar to Britain and to Germany in 1923. These were countries, Britain and Germany, which he never let slip from sight as he became a Europeanist who systematically collected clues from abroad in order to better understand the United States. I should say that he came from an immigrant family. The kids were all born in the U.S., but the parents were immigrants, and the kids grew up bilingual. So the father, who was a pastor, was having the boys read German theology in German as youngsters. And Reinhold Niebuhr was the one that brought a person who became a famous theologian, another one at Union, Paul Tillich. Because Niebuhr had read Tillich in German before Tillich was in English. So, and he was always a bit of an Anglophile, ended up marrying an Oxford don, Ursula. But looking for some clues abroad and what's happening there as insight for what's happening in the United States became a part of what arose during his Detroit years. Now, I'll just read you this from his time in Detroit. In 39, he's thinking back. Such theological convictions which I hold today began to dawn upon me during the end of a pastorate in a great industrial city. They dawned upon me because the simple little moral homilies, which were preached in that as in other cities, by myself and others, seemed completely irrelevant to the brutal facts of life in a great industrial center. Whether irrelevant or not, they were certainly futile. They did not change human actions or attitudes in any problem of collective behavior by a hair's breadth, though they may well have helped to preserve private amenities and to assuage individual frustrations. So he didn't find anything happening in the churches in Detroit really addressing the issues of urbanization, industrialization, racism, so on. And he goes on to say that the convictions which dawned in my pastorates were elaborated in a teaching position in a theological seminary. And that was at Union, where he taught from 28 to 1960. Now I gotta move on here. Incidentally, Niebuhr joined the faculty at Union on a faculty vote, and he won that vote by one vote. They almost rejected Reinhold Niebuhr at that point. The reason was he had no PhD. And were they going to allow a PhD? If Niebuhr were to apply to a position at Union Seminary today, he wouldn't even get past the search application process. He also wanted to go to Union after college and study in seminary there. They rejected him because Elmhurst College, from which he had graduated, a little college of his denomination, was not accredited, and Union wouldn't accept any students from an unaccredited college. Now, Yale would. So he went to Yale, and he ended up getting both his Bachelor of Divinity, it was called at that time, and his master's degree in the same two-year period at Yale. Okay, the last item I'm going to say about Niebuhr and the Detroit years that sticks with him forever. He was the engaged activist pastor in Detroit, and he never lost that during all those years in an academic position at Union. He had an uncanny sense for power dynamics and a real trained nose for getting a toehold in structures and systems and institutions. One of his students at Union, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, commented later about the rise of German fascism, quote, "Silence in the face of evil is itself evil." That was also a conviction of Reinhold Niebuhr. He's always attentive to good as well as to evil. Okay, we got to move on to the next topic, and that's Niebuhr on power and drawing from moral man and immoral society. I'm going to first mention what Niebuhr provided in Moral Man and Immoral Society for King and SCLC and all sorts of organizations, SNCC and others in the so-called civil rights movement. Niebuhr writes this is his realism. Now we'll talk about Christian realism, but in his realism about the nature of power, utter honesty about the nature of power, he wrote that there will be a number of individual white men. He's writing this in 1932. There will be a number of individual white men who will identify themselves completely with the Negro cause. But the white race in America will not admit the Negro to equal rights if it is not forced to do so. Upon that point, one may speak with the dogmatism which all history justifies. White folks are never going to give up their power without countervailing power. He's echoing Frederick Douglass's 1857 speech in the West Indies, that power concedes nothing apart from countervailing power. So for Niebuhr, realism means it's hopeless to depend on the moral sense of the white race. And at the same time, his realism says, it's equally hopeless to attempt emancipation through violent rebellion. Where whites hold prevailing power and have the will to use it, they will use it. He entertains some forms of gradualism. He sees that such efforts, quote, operate within a given system of injustice and don't make a frontal attack upon the social injustices from which the Negro suffers. Let me underscore that, because it's in recent years that we've been underlining the fact of systemic and structural injustice. Niebuhr was on to that. He says forms of gradualism don't work if they don't get at the structural and systemic elements. And so what he then goes on to do in 32 is lay out what he calls nonviolent coercion and resistance, end quote. Nonviolence is clearly a form of coercion, and coercion is necessary in Niebuhr's eyes. For King, too, nonviolence is a form of coercion. But it's a type of coercion that allows the adjustment of conflicting interests without destroying the moral force behind them. We sometimes talk about that as soft power now, and contrast it with harsh, no-give domination. So think of workers striking and the negotiations that go on there. That's an example of coercion, but it's nonviolent coercion. Niebuhr saw this soft power and workers' unionizing efforts as a way of getting to yes for all parties. And he conceived it as effective for African American struggles as well. Nonviolent power, he pointed out in 32, is a particularly strategic instrument for an oppressed group which is hopelessly in the minority and has no possibility of developing sufficient power to set against its oppressors. He also said it was true for majorities, and he said it was the case for Gandhi in India. I think I'll stop there with saying that he has laid out in 32 what became very important elements for the struggles of the civil rights movement. Now, let's talk about Christian realism. How are we doing on time?
I think you have about 18 or 20 minutes.
Okay. I can probably do it in that time.
But feel free to do what you need to do, brother.
Yep. There are certain kind of axioms of power that belong to Niebuhr's theory of power and to his so-called Christian realism. One of them is, we've already gotten to this. He's always writing about morality and power. The uses of power, many of which are positive, that's not a bad word, some of which are negative abuses of power, and he was often writing about possible restraints and limits of power. He was correct about lots of things, and one of them was the tendency of the powerful to resist any checks upon their power, something that he and King were of a mind about. The powerful will also always resist checks upon their power. I'm quoting Niebuhr now. There is no ethical force strong enough to place inner checks upon the use of power if its quantity is inordinate. And that's Frederick Douglass. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. End of quote. Case in point, neither moral appeal nor logic had any effect whatsoever on altering the course of the aggrieved masses on the Mall on January 6th, the march on the Capitol. Niebuhr also taught that evil and injustice flow from imbalances of power. This is why democracy is necessary. It's to make power more equitable, because you always get injustice and evil flowing from imbalances of power. Abuse of power follows from the concentration of power. That holds for every ideology, for every period of history, for every human tribe, from the family to the community of nations. I mean, stab your finger on a page in history, and you'll find injustice flowing from imbalances of power. Now, there are lots of positive relationships. You can have loving parents who are loving toward their children. But for a lot of people, domestic abuse is what is dangerous for women and children. It's what happens in many homes. And imbalance of power is a factor. I'm not saying it happens all the time, but it won't get rectified until there is some kind of addressing of that. This propensity to injustice on the part of the reigning powers always put Niebuhr and King on the side of the underdog. Both believed that the powerless had more of a right to fight for their violated rights than those already entrenched in powerful positions had a right to extend theirs. Well, it's not always obvious who is in power. And in fact, those in power often prefer it that way. They prefer to keep their privilege under the radar, invisible even to themselves, Niebuhr would write. They're self-deluded in their belief that they are the ones embodying law and order. This makes their privilege appear on the surface like nonviolence, since they're not the agitators. They see overt opposition to their privilege as a power move on the part of dissidents, while their own habits are regarded as forces for stability and tranquility. Institutionalized privilege thereby appears natural and normative, while the ways of dissidents appear deviant and disruptive and abnormal. This always places those trying to eliminate injustice, I'm quoting Niebuhr now, at the moral disadvantage of imperiling the peace. They always look like the ones making trouble. This is why democracy and democratic power are so precious for Niebuhr. They act as a check upon human beings' regular, even predictable, grabs for power, while also giving us a matrix for achieving the common good. Now, you have to know this, and I think I can just about finish, and we can go to discussion. Democracy is not for Niebuhr or for King the vote plus maximal liberty married to corporate regulated markets in the interests of an ownership society represented by concentrated wealth. That kind of system is one in which the fortunate few dominate the rest. And that's not democracy for them. That's plutocracy. Democracy is power that's accountable and equitably distributed. So for King, you didn't have true democracy unless you had economic, political, and social power spread across the society for all of its members. And all of this validates both clauses of Niebuhr's famous defense of democracy. Man, I would say, humanity's capacity for justice makes democracy possible. Man's inclination to injustice makes democracy necessary. I'll finish by exegeting or commenting to those two. Human capacity for justice makes democracy possible. For Niebuhr, what he calls Christian realism, what others named his position, Christian realism is really idealism and realism in conversation with one another, not just one. The Christian part is designates the idealism. How so? For Niebuhr, human beings are always breaking the mold. You cannot set limits to what human beings might achieve. You can't set limits to the creativity that human beings might come up with. You just can't set limits to what human aspirations might accomplish. That for him is idealism, and it's Christians made in the image of God or Christians made participating in a nature of human nature in which imagination and creativity are a part of who we are deep down. So it's idealism and realism. And the realism part is that you will never have an accomplishment that isn't always given to corruption. So I gave you a couple of Niebuhr's axioms on powers, propensity of power to be resisted by those who are challenging those in power, and good and power and evil and justice flowing, or evil and injustice flowing from imbalances of power. The third one is good and evil tend to grow apace. Greater goods are fully capable of becoming greater evils. What are virtues in one generation may become vices in another generation. I grew up, and in my childhood there was no such thing as a plastic bag. Right now, and plastic is a petrochemical miracle product. But now we're threatening ocean life because there's so much plastic in the oceans and we're threatening pollution even on land. So that's a good example of what nobody doubted was a good thing. And we're now totally dependent upon it. My Prius is made of hard plastic. So is the airplane that you flew in last. Automobiles, all kinds of things. We're utterly dependent upon it. And it's a petrochemical product that is warming the atmosphere in its creation. Fossil fuels. No one doubted. My dad, I grew up in a gas station. My dad had a gas station and automotive repair shop. We didn't doubt at all the wonders that fossil fuels, that gas and oil provided. Now, fossil fuels are dooming, some would say, the world of our children. And if we don't quit burning fossil fuels, they will be doomed. So the good and evil tend to go apace. I'm collecting articles these days on generative artificial intelligence. There isn't anybody that's going to back off of developing artificial intelligence. Too much money in it. Too many possibilities of it doing important things, good things. And I'm not going to back off of it as long as it tells me how to get to where I go without having to consult a map and just put in information and let the person my wife calls destiny tell us how to get there. So good and evil tend to grow apace. That's a Niebuhr axiom. Okay, maybe I should close with a statement by Niebuhr of his own faith. That would be a good spot, I think, Charles, for me to close them in before our discussion. Now this comes from it's a passage from Children of Light and Children of Darkness. And it comes from the notes of the Union faculty when Reinhold Niebuhr died. And in their recollecting of the years, 1928 to 1960, of Niebuhr, it has this to say first, and then I'll read the passage from Niebuhr's own writing. Those who knew Reinhold Niebuhr over the years remember his furious energy. His personality was as dialectical as his theology. He united flashing polemic and profound piety, scintillating wit and awed reverence, spectacular intellect and deep feeling. Noting that the interweaving of human activity with trust in God is the central theme of Reinhold Niebuhr's legacy, the Minutes from Union closed by citing Niebuhr himself, this paragraph, which is the final paragraph in Children of Light and Children of Darkness. Here it is. The world community toward which all historical forces seem to be driving us is humankind's final possibility and impossibility. The task of achieving it must be interpreted from the standpoint of a faith which understands the fragmentary and broken character of all historic achievements and yet has confidence in their meaning, because it knows their completion to be in the hands of a divine power whose resources are greater than those of men, that's the language, and whose suffering love can overcome the corruption of men's achievements without negating the significance of our striving. I mean, I think that's where we are now. The world community, which all historical forces seem to be driving us, is both the final possibility and impossibility. That's where we're caught. But that striving is profoundly significant. Okay, over to you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Larry. That was just exceedingly helpful and clear and illuminative. And I know we have questions both from students here in the classroom and to our guests out in the Zoom world. So please enable your microphone if you have questions and you're coming to us today from Zoom. I can begin with a general question, and it's simply, how or where would you position Reinhold Niebuhr in the current political landscape?
Yeah. I think I'd have to first. Well, I have to first say that some things are of perennial significance from Niebuhr. That focus on morality and power and the play of power as essential to understanding different groups as well as individuals, but especially groups, positions, I think is a perennial contribution of Niebuhr. And in some ways, the thesis of moral man and immoral society also continues to hold. Niebuhr in Moral Man and Immoral Society draws a distinction between the resources that are available to individuals in close relationships, think face-to-face relationships with families, friends, and lots of others who aren't friends, but still close relationships. The resources for changing minds and directions are greater in those kinds of relationships than they are in group relationships, where you have large collectivities. And I think that distinction, although Niebuhr later, I was in a class with him when he said he probably should have changed the title to Not So Moral Man and Even More Immoral Society. But nonetheless, the distinction held between incapacities for individuals in small groups for change and what happens to individuals when they become parts of collectives, parts of group constituencies under threat. I'm going to share with you, Charles, in response to this connection, conversation that has haunted me ever since I'd read the Isabel Wilkerson's book on past. And then later she has a conversation with Tyler Branch.
Yes.
The renowned historian of the civil rights movement. this is one of my letters to my grandsons. Here's a conversation that haunts me. Isabel Wickerson, author of Cast, was talking with Taylor Branch, esteemed historian of the civil rights movement. Wickerson wanted Branch's thoughts about white citizens' response to the prediction that by 2042, the United States will be a majority of racial minorities. Eduardo, you'll be 27. Martin, you'll be 24. Both of you will be voters. People were angry when the predictions came out, Branch replied. People said they wouldn't stand for being a minority in their own country. Now there are troops at the border, Wickerson added, and shootings of black and brown and Jewish people. This last reference was just days after the massacre at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. Taylor nodded, thinking, and then asked, so the real question would be, if people were given the choice between democracy and whiteness, how many would choose whiteness? Has it come to this, that most whites would rather live in a white authoritarian state than in a multiracial democracy in which they are a minority? Well, you all in Charlottesville know something about protestations lodged in white power, white privilege. So I'm just underlining the theme of moral man and immoral society, that we operate differently as members of collectives under siege than we do operate in face-to-face relationships. Okay, that's one thing. The other two things I would mention is that Niebuhr came under criticism from feminists, and for good reason. he was not misogynist, but his focus was always on political power. And in political power, the focus was largely in terms of male power and its exercise. And so Judith Lawn and others said, Reinhold Niebuhr's theology doesn't really work for a lot of us who are feminists who have been lacking access to political power. And what we need is more of that. So he came under criticism for that. And one of the best critiques of Niebuhr's political power was by his student, Bev Harrison, the mother of Christian feminist social ethics, who taught Niebuhr at Union. My curious thing about me being a Niebuhr professor is that I never taught Niebuhr. And Bev Harrison taught Niebuhr. The only time I taught Niebuhr was at Howard University in Washington, D.C. I taught Bonhoeffer at Union, and the Germans who contributed money for the Bonhoeffer chair could never figure out why the Bonhoeffer scholar at Union, Christopher Morse, didn't teach Bonhoeffer, and why the Reinhold Niebuhr one did. And then when Bev retired, Jim Cohn wanted to teach Reinhold Niebuhr. So he took that over, and I was absolutely delighted that Jim Cohn wanted to do that, and that became one of his favorite courses and the students' favorite courses. Okay, so feminism has their protest against Niebuhr's attention to political power as primarily male. And what they needed was access. The third thing I will say, and it's true for both Niebuhr and Kane, is that both Reinhold Niebuhr and Martin Luther King is that they are so caught up in what is usually called modernity. Modernity has a 500-year history that starts with colonialism, conquest, colonialism, commerce, and Western Christianity establishing European-based societies on every single continent except Antarctica. So colonization, conquest, commerce, this is the beginnings of the global economy, with it's the Dutch East and West Indies that are the first global corporations, and the Christian, Western Christian mission enterprise. That's the beginning of modernity in a lot of people's attention. Now, the second element of modernity is a 300-year project, which is the arising of the rise of the Industrial Revolution and 17th century science and technology and its making of the natural world the object of not just study, but control. The purpose of 17th century science and technology is to get a grip on how nature works so that it can be turned to human benefit and services. Those two together, the 300 years, Industrial Revolution, science and technology since then, and the 500-year project of post-colonial theology, are not really on the radar of they're not unknown to Niebuhr and King, but Niebuhr and King both operate in a world which is a human-to-human world. It's a world where if you talk about justice, you're talking about justice between and among human groups. Or if you're talking about peace, you're talking about peace between human groups. What we face now, I'm not blaming them for not being people of our time. I'm not blaming them, but what I'm saying is that now, unless you have peace with and to the natural world, and unless you give nature, the natural world, its due, you will also not have a human world.
Larry, that is fantastic. Can we go 10 or 15 more minutes?
I'm good. That's up to you. I'll stop there.
We have a question from someone I recognize to be an old classmate of mine, Harvard Divinity School. I think he's calling from Nashville. Jess Hale, for you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for remembering, Charles. good Professor Rasmussen, would you, to the extent that we still have a Christian frame operative in this country's, resonating in this country's political discourse, would you think that Niebuhr would permit or encourage explicit use of Christian symbols and frames, like a symbolic vision of the kingdom of God? And I'm thinking of King and William Barber in their use. Are you specifically concerning moral issues involving race and white supremacy?
or is his realism more Rawlsian and incremental? I mean, he certainly isn't as Christological as Bonhoeffer.
No.
I think there's a question in there.
Yeah, there is. It's a very good question. And I have to answer it historically. when Reinhold Niebuhr was at Union, and his colleague, who was underestimated all the time, but was ever as important in many ways, namely John Coleman Bennett, they were the forces in Christian social ethics there at the time. At the time of their rallying of people to the causes of social justice, they could assume a Christian formation on the part of Protestants and Catholics in the society. And they did. They never spent their time on issues of basic Christian formation. That was in the hands of other people. It wasn't in the hands of those people who were addressing the big social justice and peace questions. Now, that has all changed. We cannot assume that anymore and ought not to, and much of it has been overtaken in ranks that Niebuhr and Bennett did not approve. For example, Bennett especially had a running argument with Billy Graham and the evangelicals and critique of them. Well, the evangelicals have continued to focus on Christian moral formation. So I think, and of course, what you mentioned, William Barber, earlier, the Niebuhr ranks, Jesse Jackson and others, who always attended to these things and used Christian symbols, and never with criticism from Niebuhr and Bennett. But I think were Niebuhr around today, he would be detailing the relevance of basic Christian symbols for our formation of character and conduct. Definitely. But at that time, it wasn't, to their mind, necessary. It was you already had folks who would show up when the appeals were made to the churches on these issues. I mean, I remember as a student, we were there all the time. And it was on the basis of our Christian conscience that we were. But now that conscience is not a part of the culture's own moral formation, yes, they would be back. They would be doing that.
That's such an interesting point. Wow. Thank you. Other questions? Yes, Barbara Thompson, please.
Hi, thank you. This is fascinating to me. I think I'm a bit of an interloper because I'm not an academic. I just saw this lecture posted on Facebook. But and I wanted to somewhat reflect just for a second on the question and tell you that I was part of a reading group this past year. We started with Exclusion and Embrace by Miroslav Volf and then Jesus and the Disinherited, but we went on to read Moral Man and Immoral Society. And a lot of people in the group were survivors of the war in Bosnia or working on the border of Ukraine. And that book just meant so much to each one of us. My own experience during the war in Bosnia, interviewing child survivors of war there, left me with the same craving that I felt in our group, which was for someone to say something that is true and real about human nature. Oh. And some of you may know Luther Smith, who
is a Howard Thurman expert. He's here in Atlanta where I am and worked with us in starting some schools for refugee kids. But he told me that Reinhold Niebuhr isn't even read anymore, and he found out in most seminaries, and he was just shocked. So actually, that's the background for my question. When Trump first came to power, I remember taking part in two demonstrations, one as part of the women's movement and one on behalf of refugees and immigrants. And they were really heady, wonderful experiences, and they accomplished absolutely nothing from what I could see other than to make us feel good. And then I read in my research, right now I'm working on a project on beloved community and education, and Miles Horton, Miles Horton is who led me to Reinhold Niebuhr. But I was reading about King's experience of moving from sort of a optimistic view of human nature to where he thought he could use information and dialogue and persuasion to create a situation where white people would join the civil rights movement or where they would give up power. And I think through the influence of Reinhold Niebuhr, I don't know this to be true, but I know he got more realistic and he realized that only power, some kind of power could affect power. So this is my question after all that. The thing that strikes me about King is he moved to boycotts and things that would really hurt people's pocketbooks. But I don't really see that motivation in the people that I'm with. Their pocketbooks are actually doing quite well. And they don't necessarily want to move to an aggressive confrontation with power. I don't see that. But anyway, I just wondered, would Reinhold Niebuhr have any good advice to give us for the situation we find ourselves in, where really most people want to talk and protest, but they don't want to give anything up of their well-earned comfort? I speak not as a judge, but as a participant.
Yeah. Thank you for splendid remarks and reflections on your own experience. I think I would answer this way. Niebuhr always had a running argument with what was called liberalism. And liberalism was a confidence in human nature, a confidence that we could make progress and that we could secure progress. And Niebuhr says, you know, in the end, I guess I am a liberal, but it's not in that way. I'm a liberal in the sense that I think we have to have freedom, room to move. But in his critique of liberalism, Niebuhr critiqued the people that you're just mentioning. People who were ready to protest, people who were good critics, that is, able critics of society, but who were not ready to change their way of life as a consequence of what needed to be done. Now, I spend my time, and I have for 30 years, on climate issues. And I run into folks all the time, and I am among them some of the time, who are ready to do lots of things, but not to give up. I'm not stopping flying to see my grandkids in Brooklyn. And I live in Santa Fe. I haven't quit driving, even though I can drive an electric vehicle. My electric vehicle is just as dirty a car to build as my neighbor's fossil fuel. It's better to run. It's not any better. to put on the road, to build it on the road. So I haven't made major changes in my way of life. I haven't downsized the place I'm living in. Among the liberals.
You have solar energy, from my recollection.
Yeah, we've got all of that, but that doesn't scale up.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have 100% by January of solar panels to take care of the heat pumps that we put in, that are now running on electricity generated by the city, which is generating it in part through natural gas. So burning. So I still am not free of these things. So I just think the point that's being made is that there still isn't, in many cases, the power confrontation that's required to force a change in a way of life that isn't adequately addressing climate. And I certainly know that people find lots of ways to not to even address the issues themselves. They're just not going there. They're just not studying it, in some cases, even. You know that Governor DeSantis had the state of Florida scrub the reference to climate change on every single one of the state's references to climate change on their websites. The capacity for this is awful. And Rhino Niebuhr, here's another contribution from Niebuhr, and then I'll say one more thing about why I think King got some things right that Niebuhr didn't. Niebuhr's contribution is that reason serves our ideological purposes. Doesn't mean we should give up on reason. It'll just never be free of the interests, especially the collective interests that are our interests. And I think I see that borne out again and again. So even when people talk about climate change, they find ways to do it such that their reasoning serves to allow their fossil fuel way of life to remain in place. Okay, I want to say just one more thing about Niebuhr and King. I think King had a firmer grip on the hold of economic injustice than Niebuhr did. That is because Niebuhr always responded to context. Niebuhr ran as a democratic socialist, ran for Congress, got absolutely trounced, and was converted by FDR, by Roosevelt, to a kind of government-regulated capitalism. And both Niebuhr and King were very impressed, especially with Scandinavian capitalism. It's not socialism. Well, I mean, they're a party, Social Democrats, but it's still a capitalist order in those countries, Finland, Sweden, Norway, Denmark. But Niebuhr gave up some of his most biting critiques of capitalism. And King became more radical as the years went on. Niebuhr became less radical as the years went on, when it came to economic possibilities and injustice. And likewise, I think King's grip on what genuine democracy is, he had a better grip on that than Niebuhr. Niebuhr, they both agreed that it's about the distribution of economic, social, and political power, but Niebuhr was readier to accept compromises than King was.
Larry, we have 5 minutes, and Missy has her hand raised. Can we do this in 5 minutes? Let's try.
Oh, sure. So just for cheerfulness sake, I will say that I have studied the irony of American history with was at Hampton Sydney for several different groups, and they really liked it. So I've only read 2 of his works. I found them very insightful. But then you look back and you go, oh, this was written 60 years ago. It's still, like, absolutely pertinent.
Yeah.
And we still got all the same problems, which, like, I didn't read into his work any feeling of despair because mankind has not seemed to progress one iota. I mean, there's occasionally a sense of humor, and it sounds like there was a sense of humor in their marriage. And I know one of the dedications of his book, he, you know, dedicated it to his wife without whom this would have been possible, and to my children who interfered in every way possible. You know, it's like, oh, it's kind of funny and cheerful. Mm-hmm. So I just, like, how do you not see any progress virtually at all and not despair?
Yeah.
And he does seem to hold those two things, you know, this opportunity for human advancement and yet, yes, and it's, you know, also very constrained. So just.
Yeah. Thanks. Two things quickly. The Irony of American History is perhaps my favorite of Niebuhr's books. And to write at that time, this is World War II, to write at that time to say that both the Soviet Union and the United States, for the very same reason, namely their idealism, they think they've got the lock on what's right for to make history turn out right. They both end up being ironically imperial, even though both deny being imperial. Well, anyway, that's another story. I never saw and never experienced Reinhold Niebuhr despairing. He may have had his moments, but I think the reason is that his understanding of God is really Luther's understanding of the suffering God and the hidden God. God is hidden in the ordinary things of life and in the ordinary relationships of life. And this God, who is hidden in all that is a God who is with us in all that is. So there isn't any time when Niebuhr, and that's why that faculty note about his profound piety is a relevant note, is because he does believe in a God who is present in whatever terrible circumstances, lack of progress there might be. And, you know, it showed up in the very last days at Union of Henry Pitney Van Dusen and his wife. They came up with a suicide pact together. And Roger Shin, Niebuhr's successor at Union, told me one time, he said, I don't think Henry Fitney Van Dusen's liberalism, his confidence about human nature and the progress in human society, that wasn't borne out, and he utterly despaired. But my old neighbor, who suffered strokes and was bedridden, never despaired. Mm-hmm. And I think that's because of the suffering God that was neighbor's God.
Thank you.
What a perfect way to conclude this seminar. Thank you so very much, Larry Rasmussen. You are a light to us all, and we are grateful for this time together. And thanks to all of you for joining our conversation.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Larry.
Bye.
Bye.